Blog Talk Radio.
This is the fourth day of Christmas. I'm your host for You Found Masonic Home Companion. This is Dale Graham. It's exceptional. It's the holiday season. It's the best, just makes the best, brings out the best in everybody. We're also in the middle of the, starting, I guess, the first third of the 12 days of Christmas. This is important. First day of Christmas, it could vary a little bit depending on your culture and where you come from. It's considered part of Christmas Day is considered part of the 12 days of Christmas, not as the day preceding the 12 days. And then it's celebrated by Christians as the liturgical feast of the Nativity. And it's a public holiday in many countries, including where the population may not be Christian. In the United States, Christmas is a holiday for Christians and non. In 1914, its observance by Christians drew the attention of non-Christians in India to Christ. The following day, the 26th of December, is St. Stephen's Day in the Western Church. And in Britain and its former colonies, let's not forget the imperialist. It's also known as a secular holiday of Boxing Day. Okay. And, in Ireland, it's known as, in parts of Ireland, it's known as Ren Day. So on the 31st, we're coming up to New Year's Eve, is the Feast of St. Sylvester. And this, the transition that evening to the New Year, is an occasion for secular festivities in many countries. In several languages, is known by names such as Saint Sylvester Night and Nöte de Saint Sylvester and Sylvester Nacht in Germany, and it's a time for people to get together and celebrate our existence, our presence, our association with one another. This is so important. It's also we all know that it's an ongoing struggle against, people that feel the need to express some political ideology by harming other people, harming innocents. And this year will be no different than the past. I still don't think that at my age, I can call that news. Although, in Canada, we're a small little voice next to a great big American influence that is on the wane, granted, but it's still quite influential and quite at times erratic, as we've seen in the political and economic structure of that country, the experiment that seems to be fraying at the edges, particularly since 2008. Oh my goodness, how dare I to think outside the box, but there you are. You always have it, don't you? So we have, it's such an important time for humanity that it is also a time that brings out the worms out of the woodwork. And we have to be of two minds. We have to be in that moment to celebrate. And then in that moment to prepare, always be prepared, to prepare for some of the nonsense, if it wasn't so harsh. funny, I'm just comparing notes about what's happened over the past year. 2014 was an interesting year, I thought. It's a common year. This is the 362nd day of the year. There's only three left. This year started on Wednesday of the Gregorian calendar. Yeah. And it's the 14th year of the third millennium, the 14th year of the 21st century, and the fifth year of the 2010s decade. It was designated by the United Nations International Year of Family Farming and Crystallography, in case you didn't know. In January, Latvia officially adopted the euro as its currency and became the 18th member of the eurozone. And then in February, there was some stuff going on in the Ukraine, but the Ebola virus epidemic became identified in West Africa. Very, very grim news. Funny that on March 8th, a Malaysian airline flight 370 disappeared. That was a Boeing 777. It was going from Beijing to Kuala Lumpur, and it was gone. And today I hear something similar seems to have gone on. It was a day when in March, when the humanness of the hunt came to the forefront. United Nations International Court ruled that Japan's Antarctic whaling program wasn't scientific but commercial, and it forbid grants for further permits. So the World Health Organization in May identifies the poliomyelitis spreading, and you can imagine it's almost wiped out. But that's sadly to say, it's more than superstition, it's a political agenda. In June and July, we had the World Cup. This year, and it was held in Brazil. This year it was won by Germany. Yeah, just a few days during that period, in June 19th, Juan Carlos, the King of Spain, abdicated in favor of his son, and he came to the Spanish throne as King Felipe VI. Yeah. And in July, there's no news that Israel and Hamas were killing again, as they are prepared to do, and justify it with whatever. Really. And then there was a plane shot down, you know. Wow. And the crimes against humanity were corrected by the Khmer Rouge, and they sentenced a couple of the old boys to life imprisonment. It's a cleansing. It all happens. History always corrects it. Their names will be ignominious at some point quickly. And in September, the World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates was held in Cape Town and suspended after a boycott of Nobel laureates to protest the third time refusal of a visa to the 14th Dalai Lama by the South African government, kowtowing to China. The third time. Interesting, eh? Man is of such peace. This is a year in short. The Burkina Faso president Blaise Compaoré resigned after widespread protests in October. He was attempting to abolish presidential term limits. Boy, doesn't all this sound a bit familiar? It always seems odd when you're talking about somebody else, you know. And then in November, what a period of history will be known for. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released the final part of its fifth assessment report. And it just cautioned that the world faces severe, pervasive, and irreversible damage from global emissions of CO2. But it was also the time when Philae, the probe, successfully landed on Comet 67P. Sometimes we do it right. And then in December, Barack Obama announced the resumption of normal relations between the U.S. and Cuba. A bully is bent. A bully has changed his the way? I don't know. But we'll see. History will tell us. We've got some interesting music this time of year. And I'll play a little bit about that, particularly from Tchaikovsky and Grieg. And I want you just to be prepared for the 12th day of 12 days of Christmas. And perhaps you'll join in if you haven't in the past. It's an interesting time of year. This is the fourth day of Christmas. And a time when it's an interesting period. Just check it out here. Within the 12 days are celebrations, and in the late antiquity to the Middle Ages, the Second Council of Tours in 567 noted that in the area for which its bishops were responsible, the days between Christmas and Epiphany were, like the month of August, taken up entirely with saints' days. Monks were therefore, in principle, not bound to fast on those days. However, the first 3 days of the year were to be days of prayer and penance, so the faithful Christians could and would refrain from partaking in the idolatrous practices and debauchery associated with New Year's celebrations. The Fourth Council of Toledo in 633 ordered a strict fast on those days, on the model of the Lenten fast. A little bit later in England in the Middle Ages, this period was one of the continuous fasting and feasting and merrymaking, and it climaxed on the 12th night, the traditional end of the Christmas season. But I find myself that Tudor England was kind of interesting because it was the 12th night was forever solidified into popular culture when William Shakespeare used it as the setting for one of his most famous plays entitled The Twelfth Night. Often a lord of misrule was chosen. Misrule, don't you love that? Was chosen to lead the Christmas revels. And some of the traditions we know were adopted from older pagan customs, including the Roman Saturnalia and the Germanic Yuletide. Some also have an echo in modern time of pantomime, where traditionally authority is mocked and the principal male lead is played by a woman, while a leading older female character or a dame is played by a man. So the early North American colonists brought their version of the 12th day over from England and adapted them to the new country, adding their own variations. For example, the modern-day Christmas wreath may have originated with these colonies. A homemade wreath would be fashioned from local greenery and fruits, if available, were added, making the wreaths as one of the traditions of Christmas Eve. They would remain hung on each home's front door beginning on Christmas night, the first night of Christmas, through to the 12th night or Epiphany morning. It was already the tradition in their native England. All decorations would be taken down by Epiphany morning, and the remainder of the edibles would be consumed. That's the 12th days. Huh? Interesting time. And we're in the middle of it. We're in the fourth day of Christmas. I want to talk to you. Do you mind if I get some advice from you? Good grief, I've been out of touch with you for so long. I've been wandering around dazed and confused with no place to go. I need a bit of help because I've been wondering. Here's what it's crossing my mind. We're going to get into some more interesting bits about masonry. We have to. There's just too much. That groaning board is far too big and just too interesting for us to turn away from it. But help me with this. We spent a great deal of time and emphasis on architecture, don't we? We do. I began to think about, doing quite a bit of reading in alchemy and mysticism, of course. You know, it put something shiny on a string and wheel it around in the air, and I have to follow it. This one, I think, may explain a few things about the craft that's going on to this day. I think I want to know: have we missed a part? Have we done something to the sacred in masonry? Have we almost tried with our local traditions to cleanse ourselves of the obligations and responsibilities of living a sacred life? And I explain it like this. We have a ritual that we follow, and we like to do it very well. And some of it goes over the top. You know, we the rule of thumb being anybody that can do it perfectly has a right to criticize others. Yeah, right. Bad manners. So if you do it perfect, if you do ritual perfect, you have a right to be ill-mannered. I'm just describing. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm just describing. You can be pious. You can be impervious. You can be above the rabble. So that notion of the mentor bringing along the apprentice is absolutely gone if you are a ritualist. Well, I don't subscribe to this one bit. This shows a very callous and superficial surface-level understanding of Masonic principle at best. But when you see it happen, be curious. Be curious. We spend a lot of time focusing on ritual. And so I want you to think about, just a couple of years ago in our Grand Lodge, you know, who was bobbing along in that great pool of knowledge, and it was talking about gates. And I thought, what a curious little metaphor. What if I look at this metaphorically? Because, you know, how else was I going to do that? Get my head around, where did this come from, east and west? All right. I began to think that what was being created wasn't the cathedral for the sake of the cathedral. The cathedral wasn't built for its own sake. All of the architects and the artificers and tradesmen and craftsmen did not build, did not build a cathedral for the sake of building a cathedral. They built these constructs to confine a space. Define a space. And inside that space, this was specific purpose. Inside the cathedral of your mind, was adornment, not as a distraction and not as a source of focus of worship, but as an element of speechless adornment and perfection of life, of celebration, of what was to go on inside that space. The spaces were created for something sacred and noble inside that space. Sanctuary. Do you remember the history teaches this? Do you remember Henry II kills all right, he claims he didn't. He was misunderstood. Thomas a Becket. Inside the space at where Canterbury. The shock that reverberated around the world at this, the callousness, was that it happened in a particular sacred space. Now, go sideways with this idea and look at a Masonic lodge. Oh, and I don't mean the one that smells like the broken down stairs and poor lighting that it just permeates with the good enough attitude. It was good enough for them. It's good enough for me. Not that. No. None of that. Not the one that smells like mold. No. That's just unhealthy. That's disrespectful. That is. Think about the lodge as it is in the mind, that inside there's a space where something hollow, something profound, something special is to occur. And we're given instruction about defining that space. The pettiness stays outside. The weight of the world stays outside. The rank that you've gained from your competitiveness, from your intelligence, stays outside. The fame stays outside. What is comes through the door is the human, is the man. To talk about, and the ritual lays this all out in front of us, the mortality of the human body, the mortal remains, and the immortality of the soul. Instead, have we put that on a shelf because it's boring, because we're not good stewards, that we're not monastic, that we're not able to commit? Much easier to be distracted by the business of maintaining a myth, of maintaining a status quo that never existed, of keeping things as they were, except none of us were there, so we have very little idea of the forces and interplay and pressure points that made the past what it was. We only live in the moment. Our history helps to define that, our nature. But I think you and I know, deep inside of us, we're all capable of so much more than we display to the world around us. We have this meagerness inside of us that eats away at our capabilities. We can be more charming, more mannerly, more capable, brighter, more industrious, more thoughtful, more judicious, more forthright, more kind. We all can do that, and we know it. But we have this meager little thing that seems to have something to do with our personalities that allows us to justify. That's called character. And Freemasonry is there to change character. Very clearly. It's not a dormant process. It's an agent of change to correct and improve, about as blunt as it gets, to help to show the potential, to use symbols to convey these messages so that they are on our minds constantly. We don't have a penitent among us. Most of them sort of are annoying little prats. Oh, when I wake up in the morning, I change my old hair shirt for a new hair shirt, so therefore I'm better than you. No. We'd have to go, where would we go if we wanted to find somebody living the esoteric life? Where would we go? India? And look at them like they're peculiar oddments, odd creatures? No. Even in our own history and culture, there were men and women who stepped away to live in isolation in order to find collective thoughts without distraction, to begin in their way to understand the true meaning of faith, to find the truth. The recluse, the hermit, And we have a very difficult time with those people. We kill them, we mock them, we burn them. We, the collective, yeah, we did. We killed Plato. But thinking of a lodge, it defines a space, and inside that space, something is supposed to happen. So I put this to you. Is it happening? And with all we're doing with our local traditions, how's that working for us? Nope, I don't have a sense of valence about this. No. Positive or negative? No, not going to do it. Not going to do it. There is no positive or negative about this. It's like the universe around us. It is what it is. 500 or 600 billion years, the next closest galaxy will be rubbing into colliding with the Milky Way. All right, so we only have, 500 to 600 billion years. I don't know if that's light years. What's a light year? About just a little under 6 trillion miles. And the next galaxy is, 25,000 light years away? You do the math. It's a while and a distance, but it will happen. No, it's like that. Neither good nor bad. The world isn't a big sentimental pool. It's a curious place. And when we think we're preserving something, as Freemasons, we're delusional. We're delusional. Everything around us is changing. Everything is in motion, including you and I. Everything always was, always is, and always will be in motion. Everything in a state of change. Nothing remains the same. That's the beauty. That's the beauty of the Masonic art. Bring those liberal arts to us. Here's my little note for today. It's called Reaching. I've named it Reaching the High Note. Keep that in mind. I need your advice on that. Have we recreated this sacred space, and then are we using it as it was intended? I say we're using it more like a car wash than we are like a sacred space. I'm terrible. I take that back. It's too serious to be that glib, that forthright. I'd say we're not getting close. We've lost our perspective on it. It needs to be said, there are some incredible articles about Masonry. Do you know where they are? Do you know how to retrieve them? It is a safe presumption to think that the answer to both is woeful. If a Mason is fortunate, articles will be passed on. If we wanted a repository of qualified work, send the brother to the collected papers of Ars Quattro Coronati. In the 21st century, we would send him to France, where some have said we can find the best research of Masonry. Within our corridors, if the Hagia Sophia exists, it is hidden in a maze of corners and dead ends. That great pool of knowledge, it's hidden. Like many, I once defended the process. The difficult search was a means to ensure dedicated Masons found the knowledge. It took the dedication to actually search through the piles of material out of the confusion and make order out of it. We've been at this for 300 years. This is where we are. I think that was short-sighted of me, to think that the sorting through the confusion was purposeful. If commitment to Masonry means constant improvement, that entails bringing forward the best research, qualified analysis, and verifiable facts for the education of those with an aptitude for learning. Argument about the point of Masonry is baseless. In a sense, we can only make a person think. We cannot tell a person what to think. Masonry is a worker's dream. A strong work ethic produces results. Obfuscation produces dust. Sounds from ancient times are carried in the winds. Wise men speak when they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something. What we pick up is either a symphony or a catastrophe. It helps to think of an opera, for me. The chorus, well rehearsed and large, and from that body of sound rises a voice with more depth, more soul, more power than all the rest. Listen for that talent. Meanwhile, be the apprentice Mason you are. We are. Be receptive to others with skills you and I need to develop talent. Practice. Rehearse. Commit. Who the hell is that guy? Who the hell is that guy? Why is he talking this trash talk? You know? Let's get over that stuff, you know? I know. It's terrible, isn't it? So anyway, you're with me? The space is created for something to happen. And I don't think it's left to conjecture what that something is. And it's easy, I think. I lose track because I can sit there and listen. I'm sorry. I apologize. Listen to secretaries drone on a painful explanation of the minutes. If the boys were at the last meeting, they know. Let's trust the wardens to read through the minutes and say that they're accurate. An act of faith. Well, that simple act of faith has been shuttled at the door of most lodges. So we go through that painful experience. And for what? And we bring up money. I think it's painful. Still all about the money. That's really what we are. That's what North America, that's what a good life here is. It's about money. That even has slid under the crack of the door in a Masonic lodge. And then when we get through with that, we slide immediately into ritual. Very, very minimal discussion about the meaning of what we're going through. Very glib. And when there is discussion, do you think we can do better than that superficial stuff we've been handing out? I had a really wonderful man tell me once, if I pursued this line of thinking, I'd make the people in the lodge very unhappy. The line of thinking was trying to understand that somebody should be there, that I still feel, you know, it's like a responsibility to dumb it down. Because if you don't, then you single out people that don't want to be there, and they will get up on their back legs. This isn't what I came to Masonry for. As if they had a preconceived, you know, they don't even listen to their own obligations. Did you come with a preconceived notion? No, I didn't. I came with a free, open, trusting attitude of my own free will and accord. Now we hear, that's not what I came here for. You lying little rascal. Is that what you want me to say about a brother? Ain't going to happen. I'll call you confused. I'll call you one of the silly people that speak because you think you have to say something. but you really don't have anything to say. I can't be responsible for, can I? For people that haven't done any work, or haven't done any reading or any thinking. And it's not to say that there's only one path to knowledge. Get over yourself if that's what you think. I certainly don't. I think the dialogue is a big part of it. When you and I have met over a cup of coffee or a glass of scotch or a wonderful taste of your wine, it's been to talk, probe, hear about what you're reading, about what you're thinking. About 4 years ago, I was taking in so much, my library just exploded. And I had to realize, for me to continue meant that I had to read. I had to start to read, and I haven't been able to get around to recycling myself and cycling through the social contacts that I really do enjoy. Because I had to keep up with, and I had felt this appetite to go through this material to understand it. And every so often we see each other in public or in lodge, and we acknowledge that fact. And I hope, and if I have an influence in this, which I doubt, that this experience will be a joyous occasion. Not that meager competitiveness. I'm not a merchant. I don't sell this kind of stuff. Not a competition with anybody. I'm in competition with my own shortcomings. So butter off. Stay out. Get your own. How do you develop intellect? How do you develop character? Well, the opportunity was built. And I say to you, it's not about following the law or having somebody else sort of police this behavior so that we're all in uniformity. What I want you to do, if you have a chance, I would ask every single one of you to write a letter to the Templum Fidelis, the secretary, and ask permission to attend a meeting. Tell them that you have heard wonderful things about the experience. A place where the sacred, where the thoughtful, where the meditative is foremost, is in a lodge based on strict observance. It feels amazing. It feels absolutely amazing. Who was it called music moral law? A part of moral law. I'm going to have to read that one again, huh? But they start, and so I go to a lodge in Toronto. And I'm treated to Rachmaninoff when I sit down. And I can go there optionally, or I can sit downstairs and wait and chatter away about, you know, fill in the blank until 7:30. Or I can go up and sit in lodge and listen to this penetrating music that creates a mindset where the whatever happened in that room had special value, deeper value. We've gutted our lodges of that. We've become self-conscious about singing with each other, except for the fortunate fellows in Capitular Masonry. We've made the music stop. The piano sits untuned and covered in dust. I have the capacity to bring a symphony into a lodge with me. The Vienna Boys Choir. The finest music in the world. Our ancient brethren would be shaking their heads if they knew what we had done with music. They would probably ask, why? Why did we do that? I can't tell you. I have my opinions. I think it was a mistake. Start a lodge with in a particular frame of mind, I think, is important. We don't do that. Like the cleansing, sweetgrass ceremony, smudging. So smug going about our meager business. And finishing a meeting with music that again focuses our minds as we step out into the world again, as it is. Amazing that we would give up those opportunities and that exercise, that experience, and to look forward to. We do a great deal. We do punch it hard. We've made whatever was special quite pedestrian. What was special and unique has now become, because of us, commonplace. We've cheapened it so that it's accessible to the masses. We've done the masses a great disservice. It's like we're saying the masses are stupid. The masses are incapable of learning. They have no interest in it. Well, I disagree. A stupid man is stupid. The masses are looking for opportunity. And they come to our door expecting that. And we're not quite there. We're not quite up to that. It's important, though, that we talk about it. I'm suggesting that we don't have to look far for the solutions. They've always been with us. And that what we're going through is a world where we're becoming aware of the movement of everything. Nothing remains the same. And that whole notion that we'll have to wait until that nasty old man dies before the lodge will get better, it's not him that has to go. It's that attitude of tolerating something painful, something crass, something vulgar. Nobody tolerates that in masonry because of all the bullies out there and all the people that think that are really just talking with nothing to say. Everybody's laughing at you behind your back. That's the most unmasonic thing to do. Not what you're doing. You're perfect in your own special way. Yeah. Aren't we all? At least embrace the arts for what they were. But I sort of like to think more 18th century, like the period of romantic poetry. It was a philosophical, artistic, cultural period. Philosophical. It was a reaction against the Enlightenment ideals of the day, you know. Enlightenment. That was somewhere between 1650 and 1780s, where into what was going on intellectually, the movement of thought and ideas in Western Europe was emphasizing reason and analysis and individualism. This is really getting around to the time where Cook, do you remember James Cook? They were still discovering, still looking for that southern continent, still couldn't find it. Remember, it wasn't that long. You connect the dots. They're all about this time. It challenged the authority of institutions that were deeply rooted in society. As Freemasonry became an institution deep-rooted in society, will we be challenged? There's talk today of reform, and there's talk about reforming us as a society with toleration and science and skepticism, asking questions. This was a period where great philosophy was coming to the forefront. Any one of these are just Cesare Beccaria, I haven't read. But get this, Francis Bacon, René Descartes, John Locke, Baruch Spinoza, very, very interesting fellow if you want to know, put what we're living through today into a context. Pierre Bayle, Voltaire, Brother Voltaire, Francis Hutcheson, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, just exceptional. And of course, Isaac Newton, trying to figure out what told these things to happen. These were minds that influenced society by publishing books that were read by a lot of people. And upon about what the enlightened views, when people saw these new ideas, some rulers began to meet with the intellectuals and tried to apply their reforms. Like they were really saying, we understand, but how do I apply toleration to my kingdom? Or accepting different religions? You know, that's a good idea. How do we do this? We need to talk to you. You know, this became known as enlightened absolutism. Enlightened absolutism. And it coincided with the Age of Enlightenment, the scientific revolution, and that was Isaac Newton. All of this doesn't matter? Well, might not matter to you. Sure as hell matters to our culture, to Freemasonry. Think about what was going on at the time when the organization of Masonry began to gel, to create a structure so that protected the inner space so that our work could continue. That's the importance of a Grand Lodge. A Grand Lodge has never, ever injected the scientific reason, the philosophical thought, never, that we brought to the game, that the brother sitting next to us brought to the meeting. What our Grand Lodge gratefully has done is provide an opportunity. Amen to them. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant idea. What do we do with it? Cloud it with local traditions, dumb it down, get busy. Here's the rub, brethren. All that time that I'm talking about, all that time that you and I have been Masons, we have been in the process of evolution. Evolution. The local traditions are being replaced by the original local traditions. Your local traditions don't have a lot of gravity. They're flying off into the never-never. They weren't even interesting in the first place. They had nothing behind them, no root to hold them in place. Hey, let me talk to you about Freemasonry. Do you mind? I'm trying to get this idea of, am I chasing a utopian version of Freemasonry? Where my lodge meeting would give me a moment where music could penetrate, where it could transcend me, take me somewhere else, to start the lodge so that I am in a frame of mind to be receptive to new meanings, where I can sit down tired and feel energized by the tones, by the harmonies, by watching the effect on my brethren. My lodge would start on time, but casually. My utopian lodge would have brethren that are thoughtful, that are insightful, that are well-mannered and considerate. And if they're not, then they can apologize or step out, and they'll be thought better of for doing that. Where membership will not be handed out to anybody that is a little curious. We need somebody that can actually show that they have a sense of capability. Here's the interesting part, though. I guess it doesn't really matter if you have a shred of anything going through your mind. You just want to dress up and hang around with people that are into something pretty cool. That's all right. Sit in the background and don't speak unless you have something to say. Truly. Because we're there to listen to people that do have some ideas and have been applying themselves and reading and studying and working. It isn't talk for the sake of talk. It's just talk for the sake of contributing. And if you haven't figured that out, watch what happens when you stand up and talk. People will either encourage you or they'll very politely smile at you and walk away. That's my utopian lodge, where a good meeting will be not too long and not too short, just enough. Where we'll be able to pay attention to the essence of what we are. We are not minute keepers. We are not merchants doing business. We're not recruiters. We're not degree mills. Being a degree mill does nothing to develop the character of the people inside the lodge. So have an emergent meeting and do the degree mill thing. Get that going. Keep that going. But preserve time. Make it a special occasion for the learning to occur. In my utopian lodge, we wouldn't have meetings every month. We probably have meetings based on a lunar calculation, maybe 4, maybe 5 a year. Yeah, around the solstice and the equinox. Yeah, somewhere around there. But the calculations would be based on celestial notions, because it connects us with the way we have always been curious, raw material in need of development. I want to know more about, from the mentors, about how. They don't tell me what to think. They tell me how to achieve potential. So does that go on in the lodges, in the lodge meetings that you and I attend? Sadly, it's an exception rather than the rule. So I need to know, is this utopian lodge just an illusion? Or did it exist, and can it exist in every lodge and every meeting? Well, I say it's deserved, and I say this is what men have been seeking, and this is what's keeping them from attending, from committing. Because there's no commitment to them. come back and get involved and go through the same process. And that's what it's all about. We'll give you an office, but we won't call it an office. We won't say explain to you that you're an official of the lodge. We'll call it a chair, because that's just the way we do it now. And the meaning, the symbolism, well, we won't put up too many symbols, because that would just mean that we'd have to figure out what they mean, and we'd have to have a reason to put them up there. So let's leave the walls as bare as we possibly can with things that are essentially relevant to the process inside this sacred space. There was another undercurrent at work in society. We're going to talk about Freemasonry and the search for utopia. This is by this incredible, from this incredible article by Brother Mike Rogers in the Ars Quattro Coronati, volume 125. That was produced in 2012, just a few years ago. I just find this staggering. He's put together a very thorough and enlightened paper. There was another undercurrent at work in society. It was a stirring of awareness that might almost be called the growth of social consciousness. The 17th century. It shows clearly through a poem entitled The Choice by John Poffret. The poem extols the virtues of a genteel existence and has been described as a familiar exercise adapted to the taste of the time. It contains a rural idyll, a wish to be able to practice charity, prudent conduct, temperance, fortitude, justice within an overarching mantle of fairness, good male friends, intelligent conversation, and an end which is effectively to live respected and die regretted. The poem may reflect the taste of the time, but if it does, the popular taste was for the fundamental principles of Freemasonry, and those underpinned a utopian ideal. This goes some way to explain the growth of interest in something that extended beyond the rise of groups with an intellectual passion for inquiry or common commercial interests, and shows how Preston's belief that Masonry was both universal and philanthropic was able to take root. Pomfret's The Choice marks a point at which the pursuit of intellectual advancement merges with a wish to spread the benefits of the good life as widely as possible. The extension of those benefits did not, however, extend to the female elements of society. 18th century women poets show little interest in such matters and frequently little love for their place in society. Anne Finch, the Countess of Winchelsea, penned a nocturnal reverie in which she cited the beauties of night and closes with an almost Masonic sentiment, or pleasure seldom reached, again pursued, hinting at a quasi-Masonic quest for certainty and truth that will forever elude her. The counterpoise to such thoughts is a steady lamentation of a woman's lot and the denunciation of men and their lifestyle. Elizabeth Thomas's Bitter and Damning, The True Effigies of a Certain Squire, contain a line which says it all. Theometic strong, I sicken at the sight in this light of such sentiments, the words of the entered apprentice song. We're true and sincere, just to the fair. They'll trust us on any occasion. No mortal can more the ladies adore than a free and accepted Mason. Sound arrogant, hypocritical, and detached from reality. Perchance the popular taste was not as widely held as the Cambridge History of English and American Literature would have us believe. This may be unfair. The early Freemasons may have been genuinely true and sincere and just to the fair. Yet it is difficult to deny that respect and equality were still not universally granted to the fair, nor are they accepted as the norm. The early view of utopia had little to offer womankind. That the male concern with the quest for a good life was a thought present in the minds of many thinkers emerges through Rasselas by Samuel Johnson. Written in 1759, it tells how a prince of Abyssinia, bored with the absolute tranquility of his perfect sheltered utopian existence, seeks to find true happiness because the perfect happiness he enjoys offers no intellectual challenge. The pursuit of happiness is one thing, a necessary endeavor. Obtaining it is something else. Freemasons seek intellectual truth even to the throne of God himself, but in the knowledge that the answer will always elude them. The profit lies in the quest of what it teaches the seeker about himself. Just as Rasselas thought intellectual challenges, Freemasons are urged to pursue their researches in the hidden mysteries of nature and science. If indeed this were the popular taste of the time, why did Freemasonry's vision fail to strike a more sympathetic chord with a wider sector of the population? Why did Freemasonry's dream of utopia fail to enthuse the public? The answers are various and complex. The medieval operative Mason was not a popular person. He lived in, but apart from, a community. He owed no duty to any lord other than his lodge. He was free of the dues and tithes under which the locals labored. He was paid wages which could be spent locally, forcing up prices and distorting the value of goods in the barter chain. He was different in an age when conformity was a key word in society. The suspicions originating from the days of the early operatives that they plotted in cartels to fix prices and standardize costs lingered well after the actual circumstances had changed. The merits and purpose of scientific inquiry that challenged entrenched views frightened those influential orders of society for whom such things were either unthinkable or blasphemous. Freemasons met in secret, ergo they were up to no good. Secrecy was tantamount to conversations with the devil. In an age when the daily round was bedeviled by malicious and mischievous spirits, and the night populated by ghosts and the menace of a spirit world, this was embellished by a spate of allegations involving links between members of the craft and the world of faerie. During the years between 1676 and about 1770, this particular source of mischief was nurtured and flourished before it eventually faded. Beliefs based on over a century of ignorance and woeful misunderstandings are difficult to dispel. They were exclusive and guarded jealously their great secret, charity. In an age lacking all forms of state aid for the unfortunate, a group of men dedicated to looking after their own were at best antisocial and at worst parasitical. Their open-mindedness on matters of faith marked them as a threat to the established religions. Their fundamental vision lay open beyond the compass of the ordinary man. the poorly educated minds of men struggling to survive in a demanding world. Even the words of popular Masonic songs sung during the festive board in the late 18th century could, if overheard by a servant or tapster, lend themselves to misrepresentation. Inevitably, these dreamers of dreams attracted much irrational and unreasonable odium. On the 27th of December, 1726, Francis Drake, junior grand warden of the York Grand Lodge, advised all Masons that silence is the best way of answering all slanders, criticisms, and the calumnies. This may have avoided a public slanging match, but it served only to widen the gap between comprehension and belief and add fuel to the flames of suspicion. Set against this backdrop, coupled with the difficulty of selling the higher principles of evolving Masonry to a populace still largely illiterate and bound to the daily trials of earning a living, it is easy to see why Freemasonry became the province of the leisured intelligentsia. This, in turn, helped to remove the Masonic concept away from Pomfret's taste of the time. Yet the vision of actions that would benefit the world as a whole persisted. Preston, in 1775, was able to plead for a world where the universal principles of the art unite in one indissoluble bond of affection. Men of the most opposite tenets, of the most distant countries, and of the most contradictory opinions, so that in every nation a Mason may find a friend, and in every climate a home. In these arguments, he advances a vision of what could be and what should be. At least you know the source. Why, did you ever wonder why we don't respond to criticism? Now you hear where it came from. 1726, Francis Drake, junior grand warden of the York Grand Lodge, advised all Masons that silence is the best way of answering all slanders, criticisms, and calumnies. Or calumnies. This may have avoided a public slanging match, but it served only to widen the gap between comprehension and belief and add fuel to the flames of suspicion. What did this say to you? A little too close to the truth? A little too much of Freemasonry exposed? Too realistic? Too frank? Too accurate? Can't have too much of that, can we? So, we're all in this big evolutionary process together. It's wonderful. Don't be chastened. Be thoughtful about what you've heard here. Doesn't mean we're going to be, there's anarchy. Remember, we've been given an opportunity in this space to question, to reason. We're not children. Somebody big with a deep voice comes in and tells us the way the world operates. Yeah, really? Maybe it is that this is for the leisured intelligentsia. Oh, don't think of that as some Ponzi idiot sitting at the end of his chaise with a book looking out over the lake regions of England. No. In the 21st century, this is you creating that leisure moment. You create the leisure where you can study, where you can let your thoughts roam, where you can cultivate the mind. Or does your life not have any place for the development of character and intellect? Isn't that why you joined the craft? Isn't that why we are brethren? Freemasonry stratifies us. Some get very little. Some get a lot. Some are only in the process of aspiring. They ask questions where the answers are so dynamic. This will be one of the last shows that I'll have for this season. I'm coming up to, I'll have another one in New Year's. But this, I hope, will set the tone for programs from here on to not just talk about the Utopian Lodge, but to influence. I'm not so sure that this is utopia. It's a state of conscious awareness, utopia. I don't know, and I don't think so. I think this is what some of you have been talking to me about when you're talking about mindfulness, when you're talking about a deeper spiritual understanding. But we have to have a certain level of maturity. Often it comes with age, where we can look at the stupidity of some boneheads that are a bit muscular and move beyond them. The intellectual environment is different. And that's what happens when you cross that threshold into a Masonic lodge, the world of the sacred. And the sacred is you. Here's a little music, just to see you out the door. Remember, music is a moral law. It gives soul to the universe. Wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and charm and gaiety to life and to everything. It came from our 5th century BC friend, Plato. And he really, we got to talk more about Pythagoras. He says, a good decision is based on knowledge and not on numbers. Human behavior flows from three main sources: desire, emotion, and knowledge. Let's see each other real soon. It's my turn to buy you a bevy. Enjoy this 4th day of Christmas. Cheers. Thank you. you get when you're a beautiful Russian ballerina? Dance like that? When I dance, no, nobody ever claps. Here, just a little more.
Thank you.